Listen and stream the all-new talk radio Freedom 106.5 for the only talk that matter.
It's just about 4 minutes after nine. Good morning and welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM. It's Kari V and your company going all the way to 12 noon. And we're going to jump straight into Doctors on a Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas. Good morning, Dr. Rambukas. And how are you today?
I'm good, Kara. How are you, listeners? We have a special guest today. He is now joining in. This is Dr. Sean Lynch. And today is a special day because today is World Kidney Day. And I just want to have a little introduction about Dr. Lynch. He is a general and transplant nephrologist. After completing his undergraduate and internal medicine training in Trinidad, Dr. Lynch completed a double fellowship in nephrology and kidney transplant at Toronto General Hospital in Canada. He returned to TNT following this and is a consultant at Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex, as well as in private practice. His major interest is in kidney transplant and glomerulonephritis. So we want to welcome today Dr. Lynch. Dr. Lynch, can you hear us?
Welcome, Dr. Lynch. Good morning.
Loud and clear.
Nice. Great. Welcome to our program this morning.
Welcome. Thank you. Good morning to you guys. Good morning to Trinidad and Tobago.
So, Dr. Lynch, today is World Kidney Day. What was your motivation for choosing nephrology, which is a study of kidneys and kidney disease?
So, like a lot of things that happened to me was kind of unexpected. I never really had any interest in nephrology for most of the time in medical school or even as an intern. However, when I was a young doctor, house officer, working in Eric Williams, under Dr. Roberts, that's when my first my interest in nephrology first peaked. It was really inspiring working with her, to be quite honest with you. And it's from there that I really at that point decided that I would like to pursue a similar career.
Great. Doctor, I also worked with Dr. Roberts. She's like a second mommy to me. And could you tell us a little bit about your kidneys? What is the various functions of the kidneys? Where are they located and why is it so important?
Well, the kidneys are two bean-shaped organs located mainly to the back, about 11 to 12 centimeters in length. And the kidneys serve many, many important functions. Essentially, the kidney acts as a gigantic filter to filter out all the waste products that would be have been produced by the body through metabolism. So it gets rid of these waste products. It also gets rid of certain electrolytes, which can be dangerous when they accumulate, such as potassium. It controls the volume or the fluid composition of the body. So, you know, when you drink too much water, the kidney will pee out extra water. If you are a bit dehydrated, it will try to conserve water. It also regulates blood pressure, since it's also an endocrine organ, since it produces certain hormones, and also plays a role in the production of blood itself, because again, it produces a hormone that stimulates blood production. And finally, it's very important for bone health in that it regulates the action of vitamin D, which is a very important hormone for making sure that you have strong bones. So those are the major functions of the kidney, really.
And can you tell us in your practice, what are some of the more kidney disorders that you experience, and does it matter your age?
So by far, way and above, number one cause of kidney dysfunction in this country, worldwide, everywhere else, is diabetes. So diabetes, number one cause of kidney disease worldwide, poorly controlled diabetes after years leading to kidney dysfunction. It's really sad, to be honest, that people who have diabetes should be presenting with late kidney dysfunction, because, you know, once you're diabetic, you are at very high risk for developing kidney disease, and therefore this should be tested quite frequently if you have this condition. So by far away, diabetes number one. Number two, high blood pressure, and people with high blood pressure also presenting with kidney disease. Now, we could go into a week-long academic conversation as to whether blood pressure actually damages the kidney or whether something else damages the kidney, and we just see the blood pressure as a response to that. However, again, people with high blood pressure, high risk of kidney disease. Then once you're older than 50, as I was talking about earlier in a program this morning, you should be screened for kidney disease, because the older you are, the more likely you are to have kidney disease. Then there's also genetic causes. So there's some diseases that are transferred through your genes, like polycystic kidney disease, where there's a defined pattern of inheritance. There are other diseases that don't have a defined pattern. We haven't worked it out quite yet. However, if you have a family history of kidney disease, then for sure you should also be screening and looking out for yourself. Other autoimmune conditions, such as patients who have lupus and those sort of things, those patients also at risk for kidney disease. So any patient who falls within that category should be screened for kidney disease. And what I mean by that is that kidney disease or chronic kidney disease in the early stages have very little to absolutely no symptoms. So if we had to pick it up at an early stage, then we have to go searching for it. And therefore, if you fall into that high risk category, you certainly should be someone that we should go searching for it.
And what exactly would you recommend? For instance, someone who has diabetes, would you suggest that they check their kidney function or their urine every 6 months, yearly?
Completely so. I mean, it's not what I suggest. It was internationally accepted guidelines. I mean, this is standard of care sort of treatment. And it's really sad to see that in 2023, that this is not being done. Anybody with diabetes should screen for kidney disease at least every 6 months. And there's two ways or any person who fall into that, those other high risk categories. And there's two ways we screen for kidney disease. I keep saying the same thing because nothing has really changed, and yet practice is not evolving in this country. And it's really kind of frustrating to see this, because we should be moving forward, but yet to me, it seems like we're moving backward, and we have this epidemic of kidney disease in this country, where really we should be starting to get into control of this situation. So two ways you screen for kidney disease. One, a blood test called a creatinine, okay? The creatinine blood test actually tells us how the kidney is clearing toxins, how it's working. You may think of that number as a percentage, not quite a percentage, but it's something called a GFR, and you will get a number based on a fancy equation, based on your age, your age and your ethnicity and your actual creatinine value. A normal creatinine varies between men and women. For women, it's probably between 0.9 to 1.1. For men, is about 1 to about 1.3. And that's the creatinine result. Usually, if the creatinine is high, it indicates that there's an issue with the kidney. Usually, there are very rare circumstances where it may not be. So that's one test, and that's a blood test. And often that test is done, I must say, often enough. The problem is that the other test, which is to test for kidney disease, which is to test the urine, you have to look at the urine for either blood or protein, particularly protein, because this is the earliest sign that you have kidney disease. Oftentimes, that's not done and it's missed. And the reason why that's important is that you can have a blood test that is completely normal today, but if you have a lot of protein in the urine, then what would happen over time is the kidneys would start to deteriorate. So you can have a completely normal blood test today, and depending on how much protein you have in your urine, which if it's not checked would not be addressed, you can have a completely abnormal blood test in 1.5 to 2 years. And this is what I find, that patients may have a blood test, but nobody checked their urine. And they get reassured that, hey, your blood test is okay. And then 2-3 years later, they turn up and their kidney disease is really bad because nobody checked the urine for protein, nobody addressed that issue, and their kidney disease has progressed.
Can you tell us, diabetes and high blood pressure affect your kidneys? Do they affect your kidneys the same way?
No. In terms of if you look at a kidney under a microscope, it looks different. The pattern of injury is different. But I would also say that diabetes is far more aggressive and worse on the kidneys than high blood pressure. Invariably, once you have kidney disease, you start to develop high blood pressure. So if you have diabetes and you start developing diabetic kidney disease, your blood pressure is going to go up as well. So I would say that diabetes is a far, far worse, has far worse effects on the kidneys than just high blood pressure. Because, I mean, we have so many people with high blood pressure, yet a very, very much, much, much smaller percentage of them would develop kidney disease than compared to the percentage that will develop kidney disease with diabetes.
And could you enlighten us about the incidence of kidney disease in Trinidad?
Well, I actually don't know. Well, you know how we are here and our record keeping and statistics. So I actually don't know. I could, you know, what I usually would reference is figures in developed countries where they keep records and statistics. So in the United States, for instance, it's estimated that 1 in 7 people have chronic kidney disease. That's about 35 million individuals. Now, what people must understand is that most people with chronic kidney disease will not progress to needing dialysis. So people believe that once you get this diagnosis of chronic kidney disease, oh my God, it's so bad, I'm going to end up on dialysis. That is not actually true. It's only a very small percentage that will progress, and that depends on certain factors such as age, the cause of the kidney disease, how much protein you have in your urine, et cetera, which I wouldn't have time to go into. So in the United States, 1 in 7, 35 million people. How many are actually living with what we call end-stage kidney disease, which is where the kidneys have failed? And there's two ways to treat end-stage kidney disease. One is with a process called dialysis, and the other is via a kidney transplant. So the United States, about close to 800,000, about 780,000 people have end-stage kidney disease. And out of that, about 240,000 of them would have a transplant. And therefore, 540,000 or so will be on dialysis. So those are the type of numbers they have for their population. What we have for here, I actually don't know. We did do a kind of rough estimates amongst our nephrologists here as to how many people we have on dialysis, and we estimated close to about 1,200. But I can't really vouch for the robustness of that data, because it's just kind of, you call a guy here, hey, how much patients you have in this unit, how much you have here, how much you have here, and not really a scientific process of actually determining how much we actually have, far less trying to determine the amount of people we have with chronic kidney disease. What I could say anecdotally is that in the almost 10 years I've been back in Trinidad, this problem is actually getting worse. I see far more patients now. I see far more patients turning up with irreversible kidney disease needing dialysis immediately. And every time I think it can't get worse, it does. And I don't think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Is kidney disease at an early stage? For instance, you have non-communicable diseases or chronic disease, is it reversible?
So it depends on the cause, but generally speaking, chronic kidney disease is not reversible. There is some reversibility depending on the cause, but then that's not really chronic. Anything that's reversible must be what we call acute. So there's no real cure or reversibility for chronic kidney disease. Whereas that may sound as a kind of bleak thing, it's actually not, because we do have treatments and remedies to reduce the rate of decline. So if we pick you up early enough, we can institute measures to ensure that your kidney function does not get worse, or even if it gets worse, we slow it down significantly. So what people need to understand is if you have, let's say, a GFR of 50, which is, let's say, half of what you should have. And that may sound bad, but you're actually not going to feel ill at the GFR of 50. You're going to feel completely normal, right? And therefore, if we can keep you there, or even if over years it deteriorates very slowly, then and therefore you do not progress to needing dialysis, then that's a good outcome, you know, as opposed to we miss the boat, you progress, and then we're seeing you when you're down to 5-10% kidney function. So whereas it doesn't have a cure per se, we do have mechanisms that we could slow down the progression of the disease, and therefore it becomes sort of like a kind of chronic thing you live with that is not causing you any undue stress at this point in time, but that we are treating it to ensure it doesn't get to a point where it does that.
So for our listeners, GFR is glomerular filtration rate. Dr. Lynch mentioned it before. And can you tell us what is a normal calculated glomerular filtration rate?
So a normal glomerular filtration rate is anywhere between 90 and 120 mils per minute. So essentially, that's how quickly the kidney is filtering out waste products. Now, what we have to understand is that's the glomerular filtration rate of a 25-year-old, all right? His natural loss of kidney function with age. Actually, every year past 25 years, we lose a little bit. So more importantly than knowing what is the actual GFR is what is the age-appropriate GFR. So if I have a patient who is 80 years old, I do not expect him to have a GFR of between 90 and 120. And that's just because of aging. So although his GFR may be reduced, it is not necessarily as a result of disease per se, but as a result of aging. So how I look at GFR is not just the actual number, but what is the expected GFR for that person's age, particularly in the older individuals, where a lot of patients present to me and they come very panicky, thinking they're going to die, thinking it's the worst thing in the world because they've done a test and it prints out their GFR and they see 70 and they say, oh my God, it's supposed to be this. But if you're 80 years old and you have a GFR of 70, most times I tell them, have a good time, have a good life, you'll be fine. Because you're close to what your age-appropriate GFR is.
Right. We mentioned a little bit about early kidney disease. Your kidney's function is like a sieve. It's supposed to reabsorb all the protein. For persons who have what we call in the medical term microalbuminemia, can this be reversed with medication?
Yes. It used to be called microalbuminuria. Now they have a big fancy term for it called moderately increased albuminuria. And that's the most incipient or earliest sign of kidney disease. It's not that it's a smaller protein. That's why they changed it from microalbuminuria. It's just that there's a little amount of albumin, which is a type of protein in urine. So that's the earliest sign of kidney disease. We usually like to confirm it, so we do it a couple times because sometimes you can have a little bit of albumin from exercise, from fever. You know, some people have it early in the morning for some reason. So we usually like to test it a couple times. Once we determine that you do have that, then there are medications that could help reduce that. Two particular group of medications. Now, for years, we only had one sort of class, which are called ARBs or its brother, which is called an ACE inhibitor, angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor. Those are drugs that end with like pril, enalapril, ramipril, lisinopril. And then the other drugs, which are ARBs, are drugs that end in sartan, like valsartan, telmisartan, olmesartan. For years, we had those drugs and those drugs alone. More recently, there's a new class of drugs which are actually diabetic medications. That's what it actually was invented for, but have been shown to be even probably a bit better than those initial medications of kidney protection and reducing the protein in the urine. Drugs such as, I'll just call the trade names because it's easier for people, because the actual name is quite difficult to pronounce. Drugs such as Jardiance I forget the other trade name. I remember it just now.
Right.
And those are drugs that have recently been shown to be very, very effective and protective against and protect the kidney by reducing that protein in the urine, reversing that small amount of protein which used to be called microalbuminuria, and Forxiga is the other brand that we have, and help protect in the kidney.
Okay, we have to take a short commercial break. We'll be right back with Dr. Lynch.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
It's just about 27 minutes after 9. Good morning if you're now joining us. This is Freedom 106.5 FM, where you speak your mind. And right now we are on Doctors on Call, which we do every Thursday with Dr. Nadira Rambakas. And we have our guest doctor, Dr. Sean Lynch. And this morning we are discussing nephrology and renal transplant. Guys, don't forget you can call us at 627-3223, 625-2257, and you can even send us a WhatsApp message on 306-1065. Welcome back, doctors.
Thank you, Cara. Dr. Lynch, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still here.
So I want to switch gears a little bit. We want to talk a little bit about, for instance, people who have renal impairment, is there any particular diet that they can follow?
So it depends on the degree of renal impairment, because, you know, chronic kidney disease encompasses a wide spectrum, from people with very early disease who may not need any sort of dietary modification, whatever, to those on dialysis, which is essentially when you reach the end, who would require significant dietary modification. So it actually depends on exactly along that spectrum where you lie. So early on, most people wouldn't require any major dietary restriction, except that they need to reduce their sodium in their diet. Once you start to reach about 30 mils or so or less of what of GFR, like 30% kidney function, let's call it that, then you also have to look at your potassium intake. Some may be okay. Again, it depends on each individual patient, depending on the cause, what medications they're on, that sort of thing. But certainly at that stage, you tend to run into a little bit of potassium issues, and you may have to reduce your potassium in your diet. And later, starting to approach dialysis, then those two for sure, along with reducing things like phosphorus in your diet as well. Now, you know, a lot of people come and they talk about reducing protein, not eating meat. Well, you know, this was a sort of thinking from, you know, yesteryear in terms of dietary protein restrictions. And to cut a long story short, you know, there's no good data suggesting that it's of any benefit. So the real, and in fact, severe restriction actually seems to be harmful. So the going word is very mild restriction. So we usually, normal people, we tend to take about 1 milligram per kilo of protein per day. Mm. And in the end stage dialysis population, later kidney disease population, we will say about 0.8. So very mildly restricted. But there's still this old maid's tale about, you know, severe restriction of protein, and the protein worsens the kidney. And that's essentially not true, and not been proven. But we do recommend a slight reduction. But severe reduction in protein actually has been shown to be a bit harmful. Mm.
Docs, we have a call. Let's take this one. Hi, good morning, you're live.
Good morning.
Hi, morning. Welcome.
A very new program. Hello, you're hearing me?
Yes, I'm hearing you.
Okay. I've tried on prednisone. I've seen you problem. Stayed in this room for 1 month and was treated for the same problem. What's the prognosis there?
You can repeat that for me again, caller. I'm not hearing you clearly.
I said what the original program was at the session. It's being on pretty much nothing. It's a fully grown evening. And the treated one in the nursing home. What's the prognosis of developing problems with the children?
I'm not sure if it's a premature baby and developmental issues.
I didn't understand. I really didn't hear that question.
It wasn't clear either.
All right, call us back. Call us back on 627-3223 or 625-2257. And probably lower your volume on your set a bit so that we can hear you clearly. It's just about 9:32. You can even send us a WhatsApp message on 306-1065. You have a next call. Let me see. Hi, good morning. Are you there? You're live.
Good morning. I want to agree with the male doctor there.
Mm-hmm.
In order to check for kidney problems, you need to test the urine. Now, I'm a microbiologist, and I have tested a lot of urine at the Royal Marsden Hospital in London. Now, you do two tests with the urine. You put some under the microscope, and you look for what you call bits of kidney tubule there in it, which you call CAST, C-A-S-T-S. And the other test is that you put certain chemicals in the urine in a test tube, and it has various degrees of whiteness. Is if plus one, plus two, and plus three. Plus three, it becomes white as milk. And if it is that, it means you have end-stage kidney disease, which would mean you need a transplant. Thank you.
No. Let me just address that. So that's not actually true. So what test is he describing? There is something called a SSA test, where we add something called sulfosalic acid to the urine, and you get this milky white appearance. That does not say you have end-stage kidney disease. All that says is that you have a lot of protein in the urine.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you can have a lot of protein in the urine, and therefore we need to be alarmed. Because we need to address as to why you have a lot of protein in your urine and start to remedy that. But it does not mean that you have end-stage kidney disease. That's not actually.
We have a next call. Let's see who's there. Hi, good morning. You're live.
Good morning, ma'am. And good morning to the well-known doctor.
Morning.
Just be at the medical doctor in your portfolio, sir. Is it 10 years or 5 years?
Far more than that. So
I must ask that question, and I'll tell you why I asked that question.
I would have done 5 years medical school. Yes. Then I would have done about 4 years internal medicine.
Good. That's
then
enough.
I would have done...
That's enough. I'll tell you why. The last caller, I'm amazed that sometimes we'll be calling to ask. We ask questions, but we are doctors ourselves. I don't believe that. I'm not a doctor, so I'll stay in my profession. I do not know you are the professional in this case. That is one of the things I want to bring. But the thing where I heard you said about kidney earlier, it has to do something with your blood also. I am going through a session right now where I did full works test, blood test, and every single test you could think about in the blood. And the last result of the hematologist telling me is that I need to do a blood marrow. My kidney, when they do a test on the kidney, there was a slight, not a cyst. I can't remember the name what they told me, what the doctor told me. A slight little thing,
sorry,
nothing to worry
thing.
About.
When they did the test on the kidney, there was, what was it?
I can't remember the name, doctor. Sorry about that. But it was a slight little thing on the kidney. And she said, you don't need to worry about that. And then I did a urine test well Friday. And it shows a slight trace of blood. Slight, very slight. And they give me antibiotic for that, a special antibiotic. But I have a problem right now where I've been going through for the past 2 months where no sign of the blood showing that you're losing it. Stool test from that can, but everything you could think about in life, the test in blood. And I received 5 pints of blood so far in 2 months. And Friday when I do the last reading, my red blood count is supposed to be 13 point something. It's 4.8. The white is 1.2. So it seems like when I get the blood, it lasts for about 2 weeks and then it goes back down. So they tell me I need to do the bone marrow, but you are a specialist, as I would advise callers. If we call in, let the doctor, the specialist, tell us. Go try to tell the doctor about our research on Google and things, please. So I will listen to you off the air, doctor. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your contribution.
Okay, well, it certainly sounds like you have a hematological problem with regards to production of blood. You seem to be in good hands if you're already seeing a hematologist, and I certainly would commend them, because it does certainly seem like you need to do, as they say, a bone marrow test. And a bone marrow test is to look at the bone marrow, where the bone marrow is where blood is produced. So if it is that your blood count is low, it's one or two things. You're losing blood or you're not producing blood. If they have already ruled out the fact that you're losing blood, then there must be some, well, there's a third thing if you're destroying it as well. Then there must be some issue with blood production, and therefore they have to go to the source, which is in the bone marrow, to look at it to see why is this happening. So it seems that you are already on the right path.
He did mention, Dr. Lynch, he had a trace of blood in his urine.
Yeah, you know, so those dipstick tests are very sensitive for blood, and blood could come from anywhere. We really more concerned is if it's persistent. So if every time you go, there's blood, and therefore we will sort of investigate that a bit further. If you go one time, like it sounds like he did, they had blood, and they gave you antibiotics, they probably thought it was an infection, which could produce blood in your urine. That's fine for now. Let's say you get the antibiotics and you continuously, persistently still having blood on the little stick, then at that point in time, we would investigate that a bit further.
Docs, we are getting another call. Let me just take this one. Hi, good morning. You're live.
Yeah, I just want to clarify one thing, Doc. Sorry to call back on this, right? The urine test just to us very slight thing, but I'm not passing blood in any way in the urine or to the stool or anything. It just has a very slight thing, and he told me it could be an infection, and that's why the antibiotics. It's not a constant thing that I had. It only started maybe Friday alone, and that was it. But I was having a little pain when I was passing the urine.
I got that sense from your call. I got that sense from the call, which is why I said it's reasonable.
Thank you very much,
if it was an infection, that it would have given you antibiotics and stuff. So I think I think everything is being well managed, quite frankly.
I think for some men as well, they need to check their prostate for the presence of blood in their urine. Sometimes it could be a kidney stone. It could be other things other than the kidneys itself.
Yes.
Let's see.
How we investigate that will depend on your age and that sort of thing.
Can we take one more call?
Sure.
Hi, good morning. You're live.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, 1 year ago, I was diagnosed as being at stage 4, CKD. But when I look at my medications over this period of time, it is just for treatment of high blood pressure. And close attention is being paid to the creatinine, which fluctuates. Right now, I'm at a 3.1. They have already decided that, well, I said if push comes to shove, I'll go into the peritoneal for dialysis. Last time, they did the normal urine analysis that you do in the clinic. I said NAD, and that has been coming up consistently. So I was just wondering, you know, from this call's perspective, where basically I am at, if an answer can be given. Thank you, Alice Nokia.
Thank you very much.
All right. So without knowing all the full details of your history, one, creatinine always fluctuates. If you take I tell my patients, you take a creatinine and you send it to 10 different labs, you will get about 6 different results around a baseline. So if it's 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, those are technically no different. They are the same. Secondly, it fluctuates from time to time, so that if I take 10 different people's blood at a time, take your blood 10 consecutive days, I will get about 4 or 5 different results as well. So it depends around the baseline, right? So if you go from like 2.9 to 3.1, that actually is the same. That's no technical difference. We only start to consider it a real change if it's more than about 0.3, 0.4, depending on what the actual usual number is, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is that, as I said earlier, not all patients with chronic kidney disease progress. So sometimes, depending on your demographics, depending on your age, depending on how much protein you have in your urine, depending on what is the cause of your chronic kidney disease, that it is possible that you can remain with stage 4 chronic kidney disease and never reach the dialysis. Now, let me put it this way. If you're 25 years old and you have stage 4 chronic kidney disease, then almost certainly you're going to reach the dialysis because you have a lot of expected time. Because let's say even if it progresses exceedingly slowly, you're 25 years old, you have like 55, 60 years life expectancy. And just by normal loss of kidney function with age alone, you're going to lose that kidney function that you have. But let's say you have the same GFR. Let's say you have 25 mils of GFR and you're 85. It is possible that you can remain at that level or go down very slightly and never reach to end-stage kidney disease simply because you have less expected time. I mean, we do expect an 85-year-old to live for 60 years. So that's the sort of conversations that need to happen when you're looking at a patient. And nobody could predict with any certainty. We usually will start to prepare for the worst-case scenario, but it is possible that you can have stage 4 chronic kidney disease and remain at stage 4 chronic kidney disease, not end up on dialysis, depending on what your age is currently, along with depending on how much protein in your urine and how and what is the actual cause of the kidney disease.
Great. Can we switch a little bit to dialysis? At what point would you say patients would require dialysis? What are the available types of dialysis that are available here in Trinidad, and how is it determined who goes on what?
Right. So there are two types of dialysis, which one is called peritoneal, which is where you do it through a tube in the belly, which is done by the patient themselves at home. And one is called hemodialysis, which is a more sort of popular type of dialysis where we do take your blood out and we pass it through with the aid of a machine, pass it through a filter and give it back to you. Those are the two types of dialysis. With regards to when we determine when a patient needs dialysis, the international guidelines are, well, when your GFR or your clearance goes below 15 and you have symptoms. Symptoms being nausea, vomiting, feeling very weak, feeling tired, difficult concentration, no energy. Now, that sometimes it's very difficult to tease out times those symptoms. You might have it because of other issues and not necessarily because of the kidney. So each kidney doctor or nephrologist would have his sort of threshold as to where and when he will start a patient on dialysis. And I sort of have mine. And what I look at is I say, well, they say 15 and symptoms. But what is the actual level that most people start at? And when you look at the US data, that's somewhere between about 6 and 9. So once patient starts to reach that level between 6 and 9 mils of GFR, then I would definitely recommend dialysis, even if their symptoms may not be severe, unless there are other factors. For instance, let's say they're close to a workup for a kidney transplant. So they maybe just have to do a couple of tests, and I think I could just hold off a bit and get them a transplant and not have them do dialysis. Certain in younger patients, they tend to tolerate the effects a bit more, so I might wait a bit longer, those sort of things. So that's how we kind of determine when you need dialysis, and those are the two types. In terms of which type or choice, generally speaking, there is little barrier to peritoneal dialysis. There are some barriers, including whether you've had major surgery to the abdomen before and those sort of things. But generally speaking, what should happen is patients should be able to determine their own choice. Part of the problem is when you present very late, let's say you turn up today and you need dialysis today. Well, that kind of lessens the choices, at least in the immediate period. Because to do peritoneal dialysis is a bit more planning. We have to put a catheter in. So it doesn't allow for that person who turns up on your doorstep today. at least at the start. Unfortunately, a lot of our dialysis patients, that's how they start dialysis. They turn up on your doorstep exceedingly ill and needing to start, rather than we're following them in the clinic and we're seeing the slow deterioration. And we reach a point where we say, hey, Mr. X, you need to start, or Mrs. X, you need to start dialysis. And then we start them next week, Monday or whatever, something like that.
So do we have social services that are available for these patients requiring dialysis and transplant?
We have services, but the problem with our services is that they're all overwhelmed. I mean, there's only so much a few people can do when you're serving such a large population, all right? We have an epidemic of kidney disease, and we do not have enough nephrologists and specialists to deal with it. And that's why invariably, when there's an imbalance between demand and supply, then the factor that comes into play is weight. And that's our problem. It's not that we don't have people. We don't have enough of these people.
Mm. Docs, we're getting a call. Let's see who's there. Hi, good morning. You're live.
Morning. I'd like to ask the doctor, what causes burning while urinating on a 70-year-old man? Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, the most common cause of burning on urination is an infection in the urine. So if somebody's having those symptoms, then they need to see their physician. They need to do a couple tests and more than likely need to start some antibiotics. More than likely, because that's just the most common cause.
Yes, thank you. Going back a little bit to kidney and renal transplant, how is it determined who's a candidate for this procedure?
Well, I mean, the going thought is everybody should be considered for a kidney transplant, all right? However, you know, not everybody will be eligible. I don't mean, you know, by age. People think, oh, I'm too old. There's nothing like too old. It's just that, you know, the older you are, the more likely you are to have problems that will prevent you from getting a kidney transplant. So just being old of its own doesn't mean you can't get a kidney transplant. But what we look at before we consider transplanting people is the overall state of health. If you have a really poor heart, or you just, you know, a patient who doesn't do much, you know, you're bedbound, you've had a previous stroke, you need somebody to take care of your needs, that sort of thing, those patients aren't eligible for transplants. So generally speaking, the older you are, the less likely you are to be eligible, but it doesn't mean because you're old, you can't be considered for a kidney transplant. There are certain patients who may have diseases that are 100% guaranteed to recur in the kidney. So we often would think twice about transplanting them, but this is very rare, very rare. So therefore, it leaves that the vast majority of other people can be considered. The major limiting factor to a kidney transplant, apart from comorbidities, especially heart function, is the availability of organs. Because as I tell people, we don't go on the backyard and pick an organ from a tree. We wish we can do that. You have to have an organ to be able to transplant into another individual. And therefore, there are two ways you can get an organ. Either one, you can get it from somebody who's living, who likes you, your mother, your son, your brother, your neighbor, whoever who has seen you suffering with kidney disease and would like to donate a kidney to you. And that's called a living donor transplant. Of course, that person who wants to donate a kidney to you has to go through a very rigorous process to ensure that it's safe for them to give you a kidney. And the second way you can get a kidney is from a deceased donor, someone who has died, and we can use their kidneys to transplant into you.
Dr. Lynch, do we have a national donor registry system or service?
We do. Its functionality, I don't know. I will just leave it at that.
At present, do you have an idea of how many transplant patients are in Trinidad? Do we have a national transplant register?
Yes, we do. We have our numbers. We There's what's done through National Organ Transplant, which is close to about 200 and maybe around 206, 207 around there, which have been done since the program came into being, which was about 12 years ago. Of course, some of them have died. Some of them have returned to dialysis. So I think they have probably close to 120 prevalent patients. But don't quote me exactly on that. I just remember some rough numbers. Then there are people who were transplanted outside that system, either people who have gone abroad to transplant or have been transplanted in the private sector, which is a small number, really, probably no more than 20, I would guess. So you're looking at about 140 prevalent patients in the country, which to be honest, in my opinion, we can do far, 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 far better than that, because we have a lot of people with chronic kidney disease on dialysis. We have a lot of young people who are on dialysis. You also have people who will ordinarily qualify for a transplant, but just, you know, we just don't have the organs and don't have, I would say, the best systems in place to get organs to people. So I think we need to improve on that. But yeah, that's sort of the numbers you're looking at.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Lynch. We have to take a short commercial break, but we'll be right back.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
Just about 3 minutes away from the top of the hour, and we are on Doctors on Call right here on Freedom 106.5 FM with Dr. Nadira Rambukas, and we have guest doctor, Dr. Sean Lynch. Welcome back, doctors.
Thank you, Carol. Dr. Lynch, I just wanted to ask you a brief question. We mentioned diet, renal diet, especially for persons who have a glomerular filtration rate of less than 30 mils per minute. Do you recommend leaching, and which fruits and vegetables are to be avoided when you do have end-stage renal disease?
Well, you know, as I tell people, there's nothing like you shouldn't or can't. It's all about balance. If you ever speak to any patient who leaches their food, it tastes horrible. And the worst thing that could happen to a patient is that they're being malnourished. So, you know, I mean, I worked abroad and you know, dietitians will seldom tell patients to leach their food. So it's all about balance. So if it is that you having something that has a bit, that we know have potassium in it, then you will avoid other things on the plate that would have potassium in it. If we know that you're having a high phosphate or something that has a high degree of phosphate, then you avoid something else. So it's all about balance and trying to know the exact content within each food. So I wouldn't routinely recommend leaching unless you're kind of overdoing it and you're having too many foods with one particular bad element in it. Generally speaking, it's not that we tell you cannot eat something, it's that you have to reduce it. So if you have the correct balance on your plate in terms of how much each particular food item has, then you should be okay, because at the end of the day, we want people to live as well and enjoy life, not just exist to be alive. So you know, they have to enjoy food, and we don't want them to get malnourished. That's probably the worst thing that could happen to anybody on dialysis, and therefore what we need more is a bit more balancing rather than just a blanket leaching all the food that I tend to see.
Great. Dr. Lynch, do you work privately and publicly? How can you be contacted for all our listeners who are willing to see you?
Oh Lord, I really don't like to engage in this sort of self-promotion. I feel uncomfortable doing it. I'm just here to provide, you know, medical knowledge. They will find me if they really seek. I'm not going to go on any sort of self-promoting advertising.
Okay, well, we thank you for being here, for being informative and educational. I want to thank my co-host, Cara, and I want to thank the listeners for joining in. So we wish everyone a great day.
And we'll see them next week, same time.
Yes.
Thank you so much, doctor.
It's always a pleasure to be on this program. I must say, this is the second time I'm here. The questions are very engaging. The audience is very engaging. And I really enjoy doing it, to be honest.
Nice. Thank you so much, doctors. Have a good one.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.